And I'm John Myers in Sacramento, California. Jerry Brown is a governor whose personal frugality is the stuff of legend. These days, he's preaching that same message to the public, a necessity, he says, in the face of a $25 billion budget shortfall.
Each group in California that benefits from state money will come to Sacramento and will complain. The hallways are going to be crowded in the coming months of people who say, please keep the money coming. And my message is, the money is not there.
When Governor Brown's budget plan wasn't being hit as heartless, it was being called a drag on the economy. The biggest fight so far, his plan to eliminate local redevelopment agencies and divert the tax dollars to other government services. Those tax dollars provide an economic boost, says Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa.
This is the wrong time to disincentivize, frankly, companies from coming to distressed areas of our city.
To which Governor Jerry Brown, himself the former mayor of Oakland, says the question for local officials is this.
If not you, who? Where do we get the money to replace that money?
Brown's plan also relies on $11 billion in additional taxes, which he wants voters to approve in a few months. In advance of his first State of the State address on Monday, a new statewide poll shows a majority support his plan, though the taxes would be a tough sell. For NPR News, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
One night in 1960, a chess player named Frank Brady sat down for dinner in a Greenwich Village tavern. Brady had just founded a national chess magazine. Across the table from him was Bobby Fischer, just a teenager and already a grandmaster of the game. Now, Fischer was never without his pocket chessboard, and as the two men huddled over the dinner table, he pulled it out and began to rehearse for an upcoming match.
His fingers sped by in a blur, and his face showed the slightest of smiles as if in a reverie. He whispered, barely audibly, "Well, if he plays that, I can block his bishop." And then, raising his voice so loud that some of the customers stared, "He wouldn't play that!" I began to weep quietly, aware that in that time-suspended moment, I was in the presence of genius.
But Fischer was a troubled genius who eventually disappeared into a fog of paranoia and hatred and died in exile in Iceland in 2008. Frank Brady is the author of a new book about his old friend. That's his voice you just heard. The book's called Endgame, Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness. And Frank Brady joins me now from our studios in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
You knew Bobby Fischer. First, how did you meet him and what kind of impression did he make on you?
Well, I first heard about him from his chess teacher, Carmine Nigro, and he was telling me that he had this young kid who was really master strength already, and he was just a child. And then I was playing in a tournament on the Upper West Side, and I saw this boy playing. And even in between the rounds lasted about 5 hours for a game, he was playing chess in between the rounds. He couldn't get enough of it.
Yeah, this was in the late 1950s.
Exactly, or maybe mid-50s.
And he just this was a kid who was unquestionably, clearly special.
There was something special. And I remember some older man kibitzing the game, and Bobby spun around and he said, "Please, this is a chess game." You know, and the man was about 65 years old and he was silenced by this child.
He was what, 9, 8, 9, 10?
No, he was more like 10 or 11, I think, at that point.
He was an international grandmaster by the age of 15, I should
say. By the time 15, he had become the youngest international grandmaster in the history of the game.
What was it about the way his mind worked, the way he played the game, that made him so extraordinary?
Well, first of all, he was probably the foremost student of the game. Hmm. He spent 6 to 8 hours every single day studying past games, studying contemporary games. He learned Russian and Serbo-Croat and other languages so that he could follow the games in those newspapers and magazines. And his chess was extremely lucid. It was crystal clear. You knew what he was going to do, but there was no way you could stop it.
Hmm. He sort of drew you in.
Exactly. And it was like, if I could make a musical analogy, he was sort of more Bach than Beethoven. Mm. You know? more Rembrandt than Rothko. I mean, it was very clear what he was trying to do. There were no secrets. There were no cheap traps.
You just couldn't get out of it.
You couldn't get out of it. He was like, the cobra, and he was going to get you.
Unfortunately, and obviously what some of the things I do want to ask you about are the things that Bobby Fischer became better known for, which was his eccentric behavior. We begin to see him reveal that, and you write about this in the book. His sort of shining, glorious moment was in 1972 when he faces Boris Spassky in the World Championship match. He's riding high. He is a hero. This is a match that is a Cold War showdown. And yet, he's unsatisfied to some extent.
He's unsatisfied. He wins the World Championship. And yet, he despised the publicity he was getting. And he became a recluse. He moved to Los Angeles. He got himself a small basement apartment. He gave no interviews. He played no chess. He became a voracious reader, and he read everything, sometimes hate literature, unfortunately.
He was, as you say, living in this kind of dump of an apartment in Los Angeles, living off his mother's Social Security checks just a year or two after he was offered millions of dollars in endorsements. At this point, he starts to become more sort of vocal in expressing anti-Jewish sentiments. I mean, do you think that he suffered from a pretty serious psychological condition?
I think he was paranoid. I think he was disturbed. I think he was neurotic. He did not have hallucinations. He did not have total delusions, except if they were touching upon his paranoia. In a sense, it makes him look worse, because if you could say he was mentally ill, you might forgive some of the statements he's made. But I don't think he was what you would call crazy.
The last time many people heard from Bobby Fischer was shortly after the attacks of September 11, 2001. He was in the Philippines at the time, making regular appearances on the radio. And what he said that day, of course, is shocking. It sounds like something you might hear from Charles Manson. I mean, basically saying the United States got what it deserved, and cry, you crybabies, whine, your time is coming. He calls for the death of the president at the time, and again, some anti-Semitic remarks.
I'll tell you that when I heard those statements, and they were on the internet, so I could actually hear them and not only just read them, I personally went ballistic. I was horrified by it, and I didn't want anything to do with Fischer from there on in. I didn't want to honor him in any way. I didn't. But after thinking about it for a number of years, to me it was a little bit like Wagner. Can we listen to the music of Wagner, even though he was an anti-Semite and Hitler's favorite composer? Can we separate the man from the art? And that is what I was able to do to enable me, actually. I'd gotten many offers to write a new biography of Fischer, and I had turned them down. And then, until I came to terms with this philosophically.
And Bobby Fischer died in exile in Iceland in 2008. Obviously, you knew him, Frank Brady. How do you think we should remember this the very complex legacy of this very complex person?
Well, this is paraphrasing Churchill. He was an enigma inside of a conundrum. Think of him as the greatest chess player that ever lived, the Mozart of chess, if you will, and then think of him also as a failed human being who fell tremendously and quickly and swiftly, fell from grace.
That's Frank Brady. He's the author of Endgame, Bobby Fischer's remarkable rise and fall from America's brightest prodigy to the edge of madness. Frank Brady, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
For more than 13 years, New York Times food writer Mark Bittman has championed the merits of simple cooking and good eating in his column, The Minimalist. He quickly became known and revered for his uncanny ability to turn a handful of ingredients into bold, flavorful feasts. Now, almost 700 columns later, Bittman is retiring The Minimalist. It had its final run in this past week's paper. Mark Bittman joins us on the line from New York. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Well, thanks. It's great to be here.
All right. The Minimalist makes its exit. Why are you stopping?
The Minimalist dies.
No.
I'm not, you know, I'm staying at the Times. I have an opportunity to do probably the most exciting gig I could have imagined, and that is a combination of opinion columns and then magazine columns, which are going to be bigger food pieces with more latitude, more flexibility. No one's ever going to say to me, as so many editors have, is this a minimalist recipe? They'll just say, is it a good recipe? And then the answer will be presumably yes. And I won't have to sit around thinking, could I make this shorter? Could I make this faster? Could I make this easier? I can just do more normal, you know, not so pigeonholed. It felt a little pigeonholed. And 13 years, to me, 13 years doing one column, very narrowly defined, really, is enough.
Yeah, you picked 25 of your favorites from the 1,000-plus recipes you featured over the years to run in this past week's column, and I have to ask you about one of them, stir-fried chicken and ketchup.
The long and the short of it was, it's a basic stir-fry, but you make a sauce out of ketchup cooked with garlic and oil and chilies, and as a foundation of a sauce like that, the ketchup is amazing. And actually, that dish inspired a column that we did entirely about ketchup and different uses of ketchup in good cooking, which was really fun. I can't remember any of them except for that stir fry, so maybe there aren't that many, but it was a cool idea.
Yeah. I have to ask, did you make the champagne cocktail that you featured in on your last column?
I did. I got together with Jim Meehan, who's a friend of mine, and a bartender downtown here in Manhattan, and you know, I don't really know that much about mixing drinks, so I thought it safer to be at a bar with a guy who did, and we made about 10 champagne cocktails, and I thought, I'm not drinking this stuff. But, you know, you have to taste everything, and I did kind of wobble out of there. Anyway, I like that champagne. The maple syrup instead of the sugar cube is, you know, it's accessible because you don't need the sugar cube, which is not something most people have around. But it also had a nice depth of flavor, and I have to say it also increased my appreciation of bitters, which was nice.
What a nice way to say goodbye, huh? Mark Bittman is the author of How to Cook Everything and Food Matters. His New York Times column, The Minimalist, ended its run this past week. Mark, thanks and cheers.
Thanks, Leon. Take care.
This is NPR News. Top American skaters have been competing at the U.S. National Figure Skating Championships in Greensboro, North Carolina. The annual event ends today. USA Today's sports columnist Christine Brennan is there and on the line. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning, Leanne.
Last night's women competition, bit of an upset.
Oh, absolutely. You know, second acts are extremely rare in women's figure skating just because of the punishing demands of the sport, but certainly seen one here this weekend. 23-year-old Alyssa Cisney, who had been first 2 years ago, had a terrible 10th place finish at last year's U.S. Nationals. She came back with a beautiful performance and won the national title. Cisney has had real trouble conquering her nerves over the last 5, 6, 7 years of her career, but she did it last night, and she defeated Rachel Flatt, who was last year's national champ, who's 18, and Mirai Nagasu, 17, who people might remember because she was fourth at the 2010 Winter Olympic Games. Only two women qualify for Worlds, so Alyssa Cisney moves on, as does Rachel Flatt, and Nagasu's the odd woman out, which is too bad because she's certainly an up-and-coming star.
How does the men's competition shape up for tonight?
You know, it looks like we've got another veteran who's in the mix. Ryan Bradley, Leanne, is 27 years old, another skater who considered retiring after missing the Olympic team last year. He won the short program the other night over the two-time defending champion, Jeremy Abbott. And it would seem to be a battle of those two here this afternoon. Bradley waved goodbye after finishing fourth last year, figuring he was done. But so many people got on Facebook and Twitter urging him to come back that he finally did. He's an engaging, very enlightened, exciting skater out there, and it'll be fun to watch him compete.
No surprises in ice dancing. We know these two.
No surprises there at all. The Olympic silver medalists, Merrill Davis, Charlie White, won their third consecutive national title. And ice dancing has really been a strong point for the United States, really for the last two Olympic Games, two silver medals in a row. And I think we're seeing, again, just a dominating performance by Davis and White in their early 20s. They're going to move on all the way to the 2014 Olympics, probably, with a whole bunch of young, great teams right behind them.
So the winners of the U.S. National Championships, where do they compete next?
It's the World Championships, the big competition. There's a couple things in between, but the World Championships are in Tokyo in March. And this is the first year of the four-year Olympic cycle, building, beginning again to the 2014 Olympic Games in Sochi, Russia, which, of course, will be a very big deal for all of these skaters.
Christine Brennan is a sports columnist for USA Today. She's in Greensboro, North Carolina, where she's covering the U.S. National Figure Skating Championships. Christine, thank you.
Leanne, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
This is NPR News.